If you ask most people, we'll say that somehow, some way, we'd really just like to be taken care of. No one wants to feel like they're all alone in the world. And most of us here in this big country of America, not all of us, but most, we take certain things for granted. Electricity, heat, food, roads and houses that don't fall down, water that's safe enough to bathe in, brush your teeth with, and drink. We don't think about those things because we assume that someone is taking care of them. Taking care of us. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Molly Wood, in for Lizzie O'Leary, who's in Flint, Michigan, where the government was supposed to be taking care of people until it didn't, and the damage could be permanent. We'll hear from her later in the show, and as always, we hope you'll be part of the program. So keep in touch with us on Facebook and at our website, marketplaceweekend.org, and on Twitter, at MarketplaceWKND. Each week, we like to chat with you about your personal economy. This week, we asked you to think a little bigger. We wondered what problem you think should be top of the agenda for the next president. You flooded Facebook and left us voicemails because there were so many possible issues, but there was also one common theme. Despite what you would like the next president to do, many of you don't feel that optimistic that your desires will actually be heard. First example, Jesse Bassett. He left us a voicemail concerning a very specific issue.
Social Security disability income funding. I know several people, myself included, who rely on that for the government to pay help us pay for our housing, for our jobs, and it would mean a lot for the next president to discuss the issues with Social Security and how, present a solution on how to fix it that's reasonable and that's proven to be reliable.
Can you tell us about the funding that you receive?
Yeah, I receive Social Security Disability Income. It's a subdivision of Social Security itself. And I receive about $600 or so a month for rent here at my foster care home. And then the rest of it is geared to pay for the work site that I go to through the work program I'm in. I can only make up to $2,000 a month. And if I make more than that, then I have to do what's called the spend down system, where I'd have to buy items, sometimes items I don't necessarily need, but because I'm at $2,000, that's the cap for people with SSDI. Mm. It kind of just is defeating the whole purpose of, you know, saving and stuff. And as somebody who's trying to understand economics and look ahead, it's kind of hard for me to say I want to save money when people want to take my money for me having $2,000 in my checking account, you know?
Right, right, totally. So are you hopeful that this is an issue that, the next president could take up or that it could be something that changes?
I'm hopeful that whoever's the next president will at least take it into consideration. I'm hesitant to say I expect them to address it because I know that the way the system is, they might address it, you know, and hearsay and then say, yeah, I'll work on it and fix it when in reality, you know what I mean?
Jesse's general frustration with money was echoed in other people's responses. Adam Schuster wrote to us on Facebook about money, but he had broader issues in mind.
Well, I think the priority in terms of goals should be economic growth and wage growth. And what I would like to see the next president do to achieve those goals is to focus on removing burdensome regulations, on making the business climate friendlier to employers so that employers are able to create jobs, so that we can bring capital back into the country from overseas. And I also think the president should focus on enabling sort of regular working people to be, you know, truly successful in the economy, which I think means reducing barriers to entry for new people coming into the economy, and means investing in education for entrepreneurs.
And are you hopeful that job and wage growth is something that could be fixed in the next term?
I'm not particularly happy with the crop of candidates we have out there right now. So I wouldn't say I'm optimistic, but I am hopeful.
It's a big job. Sure. Why is this the most important issue to you?
Because it affects everybody. It affects me. You know, I'm a young father. I have a daughter. I want her to, you know, grow up in a world where she has opportunity. I'm not, you know, wealthy. I don't come from a wealthy family. So I think, you know, we need an economy that works for everybody, an economy where everybody has an opportunity to work hard, succeed. I'd like to see her do well. I'd also like to see, you know, more opportunities for myself. And I think that economic growth and job growth is important for people because that's, you know, how we make our living. And wage growth only happens really when people are able to pick and choose employers rather than employers picking and choosing their employees.
Jobs and wage growth were a common concern. Here's one Facebook commenter, Amy Loisel.
For me, both as an adjunct professor who's also receiving money as a graduate assistant through a doctoral program, I also study the new so-called new economy. And for me, it's the precarious economic situation for all the part-time and contingent workers. That's the growing workforce. And I think in the past, the attention has been on wage workers in fast food or Walmart, but increasingly the contingent workforce are also people with advanced degrees, adjunct professors, freelance writers, people patching together a variety of jobs, and those are very precarious positions for people to be in financially, especially with advanced degrees who have taken time out of the workforce to and spent money to pursue those degrees.
Well, and you said that this is personal for you. How has being an adjunct professor affected your personal economy, so to speak?
For me, I've found that I do live in a constant state of anxiety about any sort of major issue occurring. And then just in the day-to-day of always being on top of, did I get my payments from the various people that, you know, I'm supposed to receive payments from? Because I don't receive just a steady, reliable source of income. My income's always fluctuating and coming from different sources, and I'm responsible for tracking that. If I don't receive the payment, there's really no safety net or mechanism for the institutions to catch it. I'm responsible.
Are you hopeful that this kind of change could come about? Do these feel like solvable problems?
I'm less hopeful for the so-called new economy jobs. I think that it's called the new economy, but those exploitive type of individualized contracts have been around for, you know, 200-300 years. That's what unions were fighting against in the, you know, in the late 19th, early 20th century. And as far as adjuncts or freelance and visiting professors and people in freelance writing positions, there, I think there's a little more leverage because some of those institutions don't want to be perceived as exploiting their workforce per se, and there's students who and clients or readers who can say, we don't really want to come to a college that has 60% adjunct faculty or read an outlet that doesn't, you know, support its writers in a more legitimate way. So I think those, because of their visibility and because of who they serve, might have some hope for at least leveraging with the institutions to make demands.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And thank you to everyone who called, left a Facebook comment, or sent us a tweet. We want to keep this conversation going. We noticed all your profound skepticism, but hey, a year from now, we'll have a new president and a new Congress. So let's think on the bright side. During this election season, which can often feel like a reality TV show, I know, what makes you hopeful for a brighter economic tomorrow? Come tell us at MarketplaceWeekend.org, leave a note at Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us at 1-800-648-5114. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. I'm Molly Wood. And now, dear friends, it's time to take the Marketplace quiz. Each week, we ask celebrities to open up, take us behind the curtain, and tell us about how money has moved through their lives. Well, it's more like we ask them to ask themselves. Our guest this week...
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anderson Pack. Anderson Dot Pack. Don't forget the dot, because sometimes I forget it, but you shouldn't. What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying? I mean, I got my wife a ridiculous expensive purse, but she really wanted it. And I don't know, I feel like no regrets, but I feel sick about that purchase. Chanel, of course. When did you realize music could be a career? When I first started getting paid, I was playing drums at my church. I started playing drums when I was about 11 years old. And right after I started learning, like, my first beat, my god sister told me to come to her church and play. And it was like a Black Baptist church. And I had never been to church before that. So I went there and I loved it. I saw the choir and the band and stuff. And they they started taking me under their wing and, you know, let me play here and there. And eventually, like, I got good enough to become, like, the main drummer. And once that started happening, they started putting me on payroll. And I was like, damn, I'm getting paid to play drums. And that eventually led to, you know, different things, production, DJing, and artistry. Voila. What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost? Ooh, that's a good one. I mean, everybody should have a passport. And a pair of boots, man. A good pair. What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career? Probably work ethic. Don't worry about all the rest of the stuff. Just get in there and work. And get in there and devote hours to it. Not everything's going to be handed to you just because you're talented with a big smile. And you just sometimes you just got to get in and shoot jumpers for hours and hours and hours. That's something I didn't really get a grasp on until way later. Waking up early and treating it like a job. If you're serious about it, get the freak up and, you know, work. If money was no object, what's the first thing you would spend it on for yourself? I'll probably get some calf implants. And and I get like 64 Impala restored. I buy a big house, big property somewhere. And I give my son a Jolly Jump, put in the living room. There's those big inflatable things you go in. You know the Jolly Jumps? You take your shoes off and you jump in there. I just have one of those chilling. I had a jacuzzi in the living room, like Coming to America. I have to have one of those. And I don't know, I get my mom something crazy. I get her another house, you know.
Anderson.Pack's new album is called Malibu. It's available now wherever it is you buy your music these days. Voila. Voila. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. I'm Molly Wood, in for Lizzie O'Leary this week. Lizzie has been reporting from Flint, Michigan. We'll hear from her shortly. But before that, let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them at marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe. Take it away, Tony.
Thanks, Molly. Our first number,
3,
is how many new body types you can find on Barbie dolls.
In addition to the classic and a natural Barbie shape, the toys will be petite, tall, and curvy.
Plus, there's a bunch of new skin tones and hairstyles, all in an effort to make the doll more accessible to all types of kids.
It's worth noting that the move comes as Mattel has struggled to sell the classic blonde Barbie.
$850 million
is how many dollars were estimated to be lost in last weekend's blizzard.
That may seem like a lot of money, but it's actually relatively low for the amount of damage that could have been done.
There were no power outages, and it was a Saturday, so you don't lose as much productivity.
Plus, any business lost over the weekend is offset by people stocking up before the storm and online shopping while they're snowed in.
$50.
That's about the best deal you can get for lodging in the San Francisco Bay Area during the Super Bowl next month.
It's on Airbnb, but it's not a house or a room. It's a tent in someone's backyard.
You get a discount if you bring your own gear and skip showering.
Journalist Mike Rosenberg tipped us off to several other options, including a few tree houses for rent.
Ooh, rustic.
Now we're going to turn to your host, Lizzie O'Leary. She's in Flint, Michigan, reporting on the water crisis there. Flint, as many of you know, has been dealing with toxic levels of lead in its water. That's after the city, under control of an emergency manager, started using the Flint River as its water source in 2014 to save money. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Molly.
So tell me what you've been seeing there.
You know, it is really just sort of a cascading mess of things, to be honest. I am at Flint City Hall right now. There have been a number of different things that have happened this week, sort of incremental developments. One thing that listeners might be surprised to know is people in Flint are still being billed for their water. They have pretty high water bills, somewhere between 120 and 150 bucks a month, even if they're not using their water right now, and most people I've talked to are not. So the city mayor has asked the state for some money to defray those costs, because some people also have given up paying their water bills. It also looks like there'll be a special prosecutor into looking into figuring out what happened here, whether it was a state decision, a city decision, the emergency manager. They're trying to figure out the chain of blame. At the same time, you're also seeing a new advisory panel formed to look into things, including the professor Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech, who was one of the first people to actually find the toxic levels of lead in the water, even when the state of Michigan was saying, no, no, everything is fine.
Right. And now he's on the, well, at least he's on the committee now.
Yes.
Is there any sense, Lizzie, of how long this thing is going to last?
There's still not a sense of when it's going to get back to normal, and people come to the water distribution centers every day to pick up their case of water.
That was Lizzie O'Leary, of course, speaking to us from the steps of City Hall in Flint. Now, Lizzie spent time reporting all over Flint, Michigan, and here are some of her stories, starting with the water distribution center where people come in every day to get drinkable water.
No matter what time of day you come to Flint's water distribution centers, there are lines of cars waiting to get water from the National Guard soldiers. One case of water per household per day. You can also get a lead filter for a faucet, pick up or drop off a lead test for water. And even though the city switched back to the Detroit water system, no one is drinking tap water now. And very few people trust it enough to even bathe in it, especially parents. Here's Lydia Cruz, who is at the distribution center with her 3-year-old daughter, Jada.
I mean, I'm buying water to bathe her or brush her teeth. So it's not a pretty decent experience at all. And I'm really not from around here. I just moved here, so it's scary.
Kids in Flint are likely to bear the highest cost of the lead crisis. After all, lead can cause permanent damage and lead to all sorts of problems at home and in school. And even once the current state of emergency passes, Flint's kids and the city's school system are going to be wrestling with the after effects for a long time. Of the skills you'd expect a typical 12-year-old to have, filtering lead is not one of them.
You push this down to make the filter, like, come on.
But like most kids in Flint, Savannah Liddell is not living a typical existence right now.
And when it's up...
So which is the good water, which is the bad water?
This is the good water.
Good and bad are relative in this case, since Savannah and her family still aren't drinking city water. They've got cases of bottled water stacked up in the hall of their apartment. And yes, the city gives out a case of water a day, but that doesn't really cut it for Savannah, her two brothers, the cousins who stay there, and her single dad, Philip, who's currently unemployed.
Well, basically, I might, with this water, I might spend about $100 I don't have.
He's even given his kids new rules about how to take a shower.
Instead of using bar soap, I've only got the body wash. And I have, like, I tell them when they take a shower, put the body wash on you first, lather with body wash without the water, and then, you know, pursue taking a bath.
Spend as little time in the water as possible.
Right, hurry up and get out of there.
Like a lot of parents, Liddell is on the lookout for signs of lead damage in his kids.
Well, you really can't see anything unless there is very severe lead poisoning.
That's Lyke Thompson, a professor at Wayne State University and an expert on lead.
There is a very substantial direct correlation between lead poisoning and loss of IQ and lead poisoning and loss of the ability to control your impulsive reactions.
What do you think? That doesn't hurt at all.
So hundreds of parents were getting their children tested this week, bringing them to a, yes, this is the title, Family Fun Night and Lead Testing Event at one of the city's schools. There were balloon animals, toys, volunteers being as perky as possible, but squirming toddlers still had to get their fingers pricked repeatedly to draw enough blood to fill a little vial.
I think, Beth, unfortunately, I'm going to have to poke you one more time, okay?
Evelyn Woods brought her 5-year-old Bethany for testing. She got a stuffed dog after her test.
She seems like she's being pretty brave.
Yeah.
What did you tell her before you guys came here? I just told her she had to go get poked and get tested for, you know, lead and make sure she was okay.
The tests, which were paid for by the county health department, will come back in a week or two. But lead levels are only detectable for 30 to 40 days. So kids could have been poisoned months ago, and it wouldn't show up now. The place where any long-term damage will show up is in school. Eileen Tomasi is the Flint School District nurse, the one nurse for the entire district. That's 5,500 students.
Some of the psychologists in the district have said they're the little kids, the 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds that they're testing, that they've already seen a difference.
What are they seeing?
They're not where they should be right now, as far as like sociability skills that they test the little ones. This is going to be an ongoing issue for years and years and years. It's a whole generation here that's been poisoned. So the impact on the schools will be huge.
Flint schools are deep in debt. This year, the school system hopes to have a budget deficit of only $10 million. That's down from a $21 million deficit last year. It's unclear how a system so strapped, even before the lead, can handle this. The Flint superintendent, Bilal Tawab, says the schools will need more special ed teachers, more nurses, and more early childhood programs. He says they hope to get more money from the state and describe the situation as an education emergency, one where the mistakes of adults are being paid for by kids. For a longer-term fix, though, Flint will need to repair its infrastructure. Lead originally began to flow into the water system from old pipes after the city began using corrosive water from the Flint River as its water source in 2014 to save money. And they never added chemicals that would have stopped lead from getting into the water. It could cost millions of dollars to replace the lead pipes that go to houses known as service lines. The problem is, finding them is a lot harder than it sounds. Here's the question at the root of the issue. Do you know if you have a lead service line?
Some guy came by the other day and asked me something about that, a lead service line.
I don't think anybody knows. I don't think I do. Our water's been clear. It's been fine. Doesn't smell. Doesn't taste bad. We don't take any chances, but.
And you don't think anybody knows?
I don't. Somebody's got to know. Somebody downtown, probably.
Well, the thing is, the city doesn't really know. Flint is an old city and, frankly, pretty close to broke. Its water records live on faded and peeling maps and thousands of index cards in this big gray filing cabinet in the city's water service center.
Looking at this, you've got card after card after...
50,000.
50,000?
Yes, there are 50,000 cards in this catalog, but nobody knows the exact number.
And if anybody does, it's him. That's Alan Roberts. He works at the Water Service Center, and he's slowly been building a database of Flint service lines by looking at the cards to see what the pipes are made of.
That little C says copper.
Wow.
So, and there's approximately 50,000 of these. Now, let me show you this map directly behind you. It is that square, grid square of the city. Okay.
So you basically have to go map by map, house by house, and look at every line.
It's incredibly tedious, yes.
Roberts was doing this on his own long before Flint's water crisis became a national concern. Now, a team from the University of Michigan at Flint is putting this data into their computerized mapping systems. They hope to finish compiling their information in about 10 days. Then they'll share it with the city and the state. So far, about 10% of the homes they've mapped have lead service lines. But because Flint's records are so spotty, the final percentage could be higher. And Flint isn't an outlier. Many old cities don't know where their lead lines are, according to Lyke Thompson, a professor at Wayne State University. But unlike Flint, other cities put anti-corrosion chemicals into their water to make sure the pipes don't leach.
Since the corrosion control works, they don't have to know exactly where those lines are.
Flint doesn't have that option. Replacing the lines could cost hundreds of millions of dollars, but they have to find them first.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Molly Wood here. Now, one of the things we like to do on this show is ask you to tell us about economic stories in your area of the country. It's a segment we call Local Money. And let me tell you, the story ideas we get never fail to fascinate. This week, Bob Egan wrote into us asking about the unusual alcohol laws in Montgomery County, Maryland. In that county, only the government is allowed to sell alcohol. So try getting your booze at the equivalent of the DMV for your restaurant, your bar, your wedding. Steve Hull is an editor and publisher for Bethesda Magazine. He's here to tell us more. Thanks for coming on, Steve.
It's good to be here.
Okay, now this is a fascinating situation. How did it come to be that this Department of Liquor Control is the sole seller of alcohol?
We have to understand just how unique this is. There are about 3,100 counties in the United States, and Montgomery County here outside of Washington, D.C., is the only county where the county controls the sale and distribution of all alcohol. And this goes back to Prohibition. After Prohibition, there was concern that people would be drinking too much when it was legalized, and so they came up with the idea of having the county be in charge of it so they could control what people were drinking.
And that made sense many decades ago, but how has it persisted?
It is called two things. One is called money, and the other is politics. Money is that the Department of Liquor Control here in Montgomery County nets the county about $30 million a year for the general fund. Now, the county has a $5 billion overall budget, but in terms of money that's available for discretionary spending, $30 million is a pretty big percentage of that. And the other is this is a very Democratic area. The voter registration is overwhelmingly Democratic. So, no surprise, unions are very influential here. And the 300 employees at the Department of Liquor Control are all union.
Well, so what could be the problem? No, but who is dissatisfied with this arrangement?
It is a combination increasingly, I think, of consumers and restaurant owners. Restaurants are a very big part of the economy here. There are something like 250 restaurants where we are in Bethesda, Maryland alone. And the restaurants can't get the wine, the beer, the spirits they want. They have to order them through the DLC, and the DLC routinely screws up the orders. They don't have what they want. They deliver the wrong thing. The week of Christmas, there was a major screw-up where they delivered everything for the whole week in one day, and it was just on and on. There are these problems. And the other is just consumers. The consumers have to pay more, and their selection isn't as good because of this. And many, many people go across the Potomac River to Virginia to go to stores there, or they go into Washington, D.C. I was at a store in D.C. last week, and more than half of the license plates in the parking lot were from Maryland.
Oh, interesting. So potentially losing business to surrounding counties and surrounding
yes.
states.
There's one irony here, and that is Total Wine & More, which is the largest privately held spirits retailer in the United States, has 130 stores all across the country. They are based here in Bethesda, just miles from where we are right now. And yet they don't have a store in Montgomery County because of the DLC.
Well, so then when you put it that way, it seems like ending the monopoly would be pretty obvious. What's the opposition?
Again, it comes down to politics. The county executive is there are now two bills before the state legislature to introduce competition for the DLC. There's a huge political fight going on, and it's Democrats versus Democrats. And the county executive is leading the fight against because he doesn't see a way to replace that $30 million. And what he has been saying is if the DLC goes away, it will result in about an average of $100 per person increase in taxes per year.
And is there a counter argument to that? That seems to be one of his complaints, is that no one's put forward a counterfactual, if you will.
Yes. The problem is there are lots of suggestions and options for how to offset that. But the reality is that it's up to the state to impose new taxes. And that's not going to happen. It's simply not in this political environment. So it doesn't seem that there is a way to replace that $30 million. Now, there absolutely is lots of talk, and the state comptroller just came out with a study that basically said that there'll be so much more, there's so many more sales and so much more economic activity and so many more jobs that in the end, the county will come out ahead. But the county executive and so far the county council aren't buying that.
And so what, if you had to guess, how do you think it would come out? Is the change to privatization inevitable?
I think it's inevitable. I don't think it's going to be happening this coming year. The Maryland state legislature, which must approve any change, is only in session for 3 months out of the year. And while there are two bills, word is that they're probably not going anywhere. But I think this is like so many big changes. It just takes a while. I think this is inevitable. It's just a question of when.
So maybe one more holiday season of missed cocktail deliveries.
I think that's probably going to be the case.
That's Steve Hull, editor and publisher at Bethesda Magazine. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Come tell us what's the most important economic story where you live. Go to marketplaceweekend.org and click on Local Money. This is Marketplace Weekend. I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Lizzie O'Leary this week. You know that business jargon, long and short? Long as in betting on something and short as in betting against it. On Wall Street, investors do that with stocks. We do it with news stories. And this week, with their bets, we've got senior writer from Bloomberg Businessweek, Sam Grobart, and Marketplace's own Kimberly Adams. And I'm going to jump right in with you, Sam.
Okay.
What are you long on this week in the news?
This week, I am long on college admissions becoming perhaps a little bit more humane. Last week, there was a study released by Harvard's Graduate School of Education called Turning the Tide. And it makes some very specific recommendations. So it starts off by saying, first of all, we have to de-emphasize the role standardized testing plays. And then also we need to limit the number of extracurriculars that we're really going to pay attention to because we don't want people just padding their resumes. And then also it says that there's been way too much attention placed on AP level courses in high school.
But we're not necessarily talking about kids getting an easier ride, are we? Or having, you know, we're also at a time when America's education standards arguably haven't matched up in the same way that they used to.
That's
true.
Are we
going to give a trophy to everybody just to play devil's advocate?
Well, one of the critiques of this proposal is that it may, in fact, grow the applicant pool for colleges, which might make it even more competitive if now a larger number of people are competing for the same number of spots that are available each fall.
But the people who are supportive of measures like this point out that those AP classes tend only to be available in wealthier schools and less available to minority students. And
exactly.
Also, if you're looking so much at extracurricular activities and volunteer work, well, if you're from a poor family and you have to work after school, then you can't do those extracurricular activities. Or if your school doesn't offer them or you can't afford them, it's a social or sometimes a racial hindrance if these things are weighted so heavily in admissions processes.
That's exactly right, Kimberly. And the proposal acknowledges that and says that also what should count is working outside of school to earn a living and also to help your family if that's what you're dealing with.
All right, Kimberly, what are you long on this week?
I'm going to go international, and I am long on Iranian consumers because now that the sanctions have been lifted, their president pretty much immediately hopped on a plane to Europe and just started this rash of signing trade deals. And the Europeans are so excited about this because why? All of the sudden, this market of something like, I think, 80 million people, highly educated, income to spare, who have been really desirous of international products over the time of these sanctions, now suddenly that market is open and companies are having a field day. They just cannot wait. And so I think Iranian consumers are not only going to give a boost to European companies in particular seem to be jumping on this bandwagon, but also I think that we're going to now start seeing a lot more of Iranian culture represented in the market and the marketplace. And it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out.
Well, and like you said, the government is going on a buying spree because they have $30 to $55 billion that they didn't have before, depending on how you measure the money, the assets that have been frozen. Correct.
And for the Europeans, they must be thrilled because their economy has been fairly stagnant. So here's, hey, somebody with money, go talk to that person.
It's not just China anymore. There's a whole other country to bet your entire future on.
Although we should mention that money you're talking about, Molly, a lot of people are really upset about the fact that Iran is getting that money back because they consider it either a ransom for the price of these Americans who were recently released from Iranian prisons or effectively illicit gains to Iran from some of the dodgy things that they've been doing over the years.
Yeah, it's a complicated shopping trip. For sure. But
for sure.
I think long on Iranian consumers seems like the positive way to look at it. Let's turn,
mention, though, that in Italy, when Hassan Rouhani was in Italy, they actually covered up some of the naked statues in the various places that he was visited so as not to offend him. So there are these big gray boxes surrounding these, you know, famous marble statues.
Oh, isn't it ever the way to appease the visiting? Right, exactly. To appease the visiting money. All right. On that want note, let's turn to the topics that we're not so positive about. Sam, what are you short on?
Molly, I'm short on driving. There was
what?
A study. Yes, people are not interested in driving as much as they used to be. There was a big study that came out from the University of Michigan, a state that has some interest in how people drive and how many of them drive. And it's been showing that among younger Americans, there has been a steady decline in the number of driver's licenses issued. And at the same time, technology and new businesses, things like Lyft and Uber and eventually self-driving cars, are kind of going to take the driving out of the hands of the consumer and either put them into professionals or computers.
And people are also living more broke, as in they can't afford a car, especially if you're talking about these younger people that would be covered in that range, that date range you mentioned. If you can't afford a car or your friends don't have cars, I would imagine there's very little incentive for you to get a driver's license.
Exactly.
Yeah. A car is a luxury. Kimberly, what about you? What are you short on?
I am short on Oscars television ratings because hashtag Oscars so white. We've got not only these civil rights leaders, but also famous celebrities, Will and Jada Pinkett Smith, Spike Lee, are all calling for an Oscar boycott, despite the fact that Chris Rock is hosting and people have said, you know, we support Chris Rock, but we don't support the fact that there's not much, if any, diversity in Oscar nominations. But what I think is more important is the fact that on social media, this is really gaining a lot of traction. And I think, and this is pure speculation on my part, that a lot of people are going to voice their protest by just not watching.
Well, and haven't Oscar ratings been declining anyway? It feels like this could be the tipping point if people just start to say, well, no, it's not relevant to me. I feel like it's not relevant to me. And I'm a white lady and I'm not interested in watching it.
You know, the Oscar nominating committee, the Academy did make some movements this past week to say, hey, here's how we're going to address this issue. Is it too little too late? Is it not enough? I don't know. But my people on Twitter are less than impressed.
All right. We will not be watching to see what happens with Oscar ratings. That is Kimberly Adams, our politics and general news reporter based in D.C. with Marketplace, and Sam Grobart, senior writer from Bloomberg Businessweek. Thank you guys, as always.
Thank you.
Lovely to be here.
If you are even a little bit into books, you know about Powell City of Books. It's in downtown Portland, and it carries about a million new and used titles. You can spend hours and hours and hours on a rainy weekend just browsing, and you can find just about anything, including one title that almost no one, not even the store staff, is allowed to see. It's locked away in a secret location, and Powell's only brings it out for the most serious buyers. Oregon Public Broadcasting's John Rosman got a peek at the store's most expensive book.
It's not too hard to find what you need inside of Powell's City of Books. That's saying something about a store that engulfs a city block. You just learn to rely on the staff. But when I asked three different employees for the location of the store's most expensive book, I got three different answers.
Well, you know, we're not just going to draw you a map and say to somebody here, if you want it, come and get it.
Michael Powell is the former president of the family-owned store and man behind that book's purchase. In a room located in a place I'm not allowed to talk about, he carefully takes out two weathered volumes from bubble wrap. It's the 1814 Lewis and Clark Journal, published 8 years after the explorer's return. It costs $350,000.
This version is extremely rare, apart from being in really fine shape. It has the map, which I will not unfold.
He says one tear in that map could potentially cut the price in half. It's not a risk he's willing to take on a journalist. The value of this rare book means hardly any customers or employees will ever see it. But its presence is still significant to the store.
People are always asking us what's our rarest book, and so it's fun to say it's an edition of the Lewis and Clark Journals as opposed to, say, a 15th century German religious tract or something.
There are two big factors contributing to the steep price tag. The first, that map Powell mentioned, Captain Clark's map of the West. What makes the Powell's copy so expensive is not only that it includes this map and the original covering, but that it's in terrific condition.
The journals themselves with the map is just a very rare historical document.
John Logan Allen is a Lewis and Clark scholar and author based in Wyoming. He says initially about 1,500 sets were sold.
Most of them were probably destroyed, so there simply aren't many existing copies.
But is it $350,000 rare?
Frankly, I'm surprised that Powell has put this kind of price tag on it. I'm just not certain it's worth the money.
But you never know what it might be worth to a devoted Lewis and Clark collector. And they're out there, people like Roger Wenlick, who once spent years seeking Lewis and Clark printed materials.
I was insane. I was addicted. It was a passion beyond control.
For a blue-collar construction worker from Portland, that became a problem.
I had 11 credit cards at that time, and they were all maxed. I had refinanced my house twice.
Wenlick bought a copy of the 1814 Journal, like the one at Powell's, on a handshake. He paid for it in monthly installments. Eventually, he parted with it and the rest of his collection in a deal with Lewis and Clark College as part of a half-sell, half-donation. He estimates that book is now worth around $200,000. Michael Powell may have set a high price for his copy because he isn't really angling to sell. After all, they're part of Oregon history. But business is business. And Powell says the set is very much for sale.
Somebody said, wouldn't you feel bad? And I said, well, that price would heal a lot of wounds.
Powell wraps up the journal and locks it back in the safe where it'll sit until a buyer comes to the secret room. And if that buyer is serious enough, he might even unfold the map. In Portland, I'm John Rossman for Marketplace.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Molly.
All right. So I don't know if you know, but election season is in full swing.
Oh, there's an election?
Yeah, it's totally happening. The Iowa caucus is days away. So, you know, that whole fundraising, growing your voter base, that's all kind of a big deal right now. And it turns out there's some tech involved. And it's pretty interesting, right?
Yeah, it is interesting. There are a lot of ways that tech is affecting our voting experience this time around. One way is that candidates are using tech for data collection on voters.
Well, so everybody is, right? I mean, isn't any company with any online presence using some data collecting?
Absolutely. It's data collection all around. But it's sort of like the Wild West right now when it comes to elections and campaigning. The Online Trust Alliance released an audit recently that looked at the privacy and data security practices of the 23 leading presidential candidates, 23 of them, and they found that they found that the majority of candidates take, quote, broad liberties in the fine print of their privacy policies. Some even reserve the right to sell or trade this personal data. You may remember also, Molly, a recent dispute earlier this year between the Clinton and Sanders camps about voter data stored by the Democratic National Committee and shared by both campaigns. Essentially, there's a vulnerability in the system that gave the Sanders camp an ability to see what the Clinton camp was doing with the data. So even though this stuff has been in the air for a while, how to deal with it is definitely still being worked out.
Right. And people are probably just starting to realize how much there is. But before we get to the money questions, what do politicians get out of having all of this raw data at their disposal?
Yeah, so they get a lot of stuff. Collecting this data allows politicians to better target their voters, but also their donors. It's really used like any business would use data to target their audience. You might remember the Obama campaign changing the subjects in their emails. That's the result, of course, of reading the tea leaves of the data they were getting. It also means a campaign understands better who their small donors are and how to reach them and help them give more. Or in the case of a caucus, for instance, who their likely voters are. Bernie Sanders, for instance, is trying to reach a much younger base in Iowa, and his campaign knows that they have some opportunity there. So the campaign is helping organize a big carpooling system to help bring voters at colleges to their hometown so they can participate in the Iowa caucus. This stuff is all the result of having data and trying to use it to your advantage. One other thing worth mentioning is that there's a whole new layer of this. Campaigns are on Snapchat, they're on Twitter, YouTube, Periscope, and they're using those newer platforms to try and reach younger voters, Generation Z, as it's called, right? But that data flow goes two ways, Molly. Candidates are pulling information on who interacts with them on these platforms and adding that information to their data pool.
Okay, but I want to go back to this question about selling or trading information. What's happening there?
So we talked to Craig Spiesel. He's the executive director and president of the Online Trust Alliance, and he and the Alliance's study looked at some examples of why candidates sell their data. As an example, he looked at what Governor Scott Walker did with his data.
Many candidates might realize a campaign debt when they bail out of elections. And so what the Walker campaign has done is not totally unique, is trying to sell those names to help recoup some cost. Obviously, there's other candidates that may want them, other groups. And so I believe the last data was about $10,000 per usage of the names.
Did I hear that right? So they'll charge $10,000 for the right to send a single email to their entire database.
Yeah, It's a steep cost. But when you think about how close some of these primary elections can get and how important they are for a candidate's momentum and then later fundraising, it might be worth it to gain access to more voters. And although we used Scott Walker as an example, it's important to note that this is being done on both sides of the aisle.
And so people who originally signed up to be in Walker's database may not have realized, probably, that their information would be shared with a different campaign. How different is that from the kind of the data sharing that might be happening in the corporate world already?
Well, it's no different, I would guess, Molly, in that a lot of us don't fully understand how it's going to be used, right?
Right.
And how much it costs. Spiesel says the argument for now, as far as, you know, how this stuff gets justified, is basically because the First Amendment, right, for now. But that will change over time, I think.
So it may not be unusual, it may not be illegal, but it does sound like there could be some ethical dilemmas with the way both Democratic and Republican campaigns are collecting and using data, if only because people thought they were supporting a candidate, right?
Yeah, and that's why it's always good to pay attention as a voter to where, just like as you would as a user, to where you're putting your information and who you're giving it to. Is it a campaign? Is it a third party? Do they have information about what they're doing with the data you've given them, both in the short term and in the long term?
You're telling me I have to read the EULA?
Got to read that EULA, donation. Molly. Read the EULA.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech IRL. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Molly.
And that's our show for this week. Lizzie is back next week. And in the meantime, let's keep talking. What makes you hopeful for a brighter economic tomorrow? Visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call 1-800-648-5114. Your voice may be featured on air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Haley Hirschman, and Shayna Deloria. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. And I'm Molly Wood. Thanks for listening. This is APM.